And now, the Hard Foul Sports Cleveland Podcast. Here are your hosts, Mike Tolsma, Adam Bennett, and Mike Arnold.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Hard Foul Sports Cleveland Podcast. Really pleased to be joined today, here on a Monday evening, by Kevin Kleps. Kevin is the assistant editor at Cranes Cleveland. He talks all things Cleveland sports. He's also a baseball freelancer at About.com. And I've said this at Hard Foul Sports Cleveland. I said it when I ran SC Cleveland. Kevin is far and away one of the best Cleveland sports follows. He provides great information at Cranes. He does a phenomenal job covering all three teams and really, you know, the behind the scenes, the inner workings, the front office stuff with all three scenes. So, Kevin, thank you for joining us. How are you doing tonight?
Good, Adam. Glad to be here, man.
Well, hey, we're really pleased that that you could take the time, and we're thankful for it. And I want to get started right off the bat here with the Browns. And Kevin, you know, you and I have talked about this a little bit. It's been such an awful season on all fronts. So for the average fan listening and you know, they're wondering about their team and what should be done and what needs to be done, and we're already looking toward next year with an eye to the draft, what do you see, and you know this front office, you know the people that work in it, you know the coaching staff, what do you see the Browns doing, number one, what do you see them doing moving forward, number two, what, in your opinion, do you think that they should do moving forward to right the ship?
I just can't see how Jimmy Haslam is going to keep this crew together, even though he put himself in a real bind with what he said on the first Saturday of training camp back, I think it was early August, by saying that he's not going to blow it up again. No matter what he does now, if he goes back on his word, people are going to question that. But you can't just not do what you think is the right thing because of something you said back in August.
And right.
Looking at where they are right now and looking at what they might have for the future, there's no way on earth you can keep Ray Farmer around. I just don't see how that's even possible. And I would think Haslam deep down knows that too. He should know better than anyone with what he's watching and what he's hearing from people who work in that building. And if you replace Farmer, then you're looking at a new coach too, because whether the fans want to keep Pettine or they don't want to keep Pettine, a GM comes in here, there's probably a 95% chance that he's not going to want to keep Mike Pettine. He's going to want his own guy. Unless Pettine's done something remarkable in his first 2 years on the job, which obviously he has not. So in my mind, we're looking at another franchise shakeup, and it's just the same thing all over again. You're going to have new people in here. They're going to say the same stuff, and fans aren't going to believe them just because they've been given no reason to believe that anything is going to get turned around, because no matter how many times they shake it up, for whatever reason, the Browns don't get it right. It's amazing that this endless cycle has been going on for 16, 17 seasons.
Yeah. That's the one thing that, first of all, if I ever worked in PR for the Browns, I wish I could do their PR, because it's not a hard job if you know the fans and you know the fan base. And who the hell advises Jimmy Haslam in training camp to go out and say, hey, no matter how bad it gets, we're not blowing this thing up, okay? It's just not going to happen. Like, I understand the vote of confidence for your GM and your head coach, but my God, like, is that not the most Cleveland Browns thing ever? You know, if you're going to say that bad things are going to happen. I mean, you're just asking for bad things to happen. And so, you know, for him to come out and say that and back himself into a corner is one thing. But like you said, and this is the point that I've been making for weeks on our podcast and on Twitter, and basically to anybody who would listen, we've been doing it ass backwards for years. We hire the coach, and then we get the personnel guy. Or, you know, we may not have a personnel guy, but then we find a coach, and then later on we get a personnel guy. For once, and this is the only thing, and I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this, moving forward, the only thing that I want to do, for once, is to hire a personnel guy first, who's in charge of football operations, and whether that's a GM or whether that's a VP of pro, whatever it may be. It could be a coach if you give full control to everything. I just want the guy in charge of football to be in charge of the guy coaching his football team. And since 1999, you know, we really haven't had that. So what are your thoughts on that moving forward? Do you think that the GM should come first, or do you think that, as they've done, you know, a few times before, it's look for the best coach first and then supplement him with good people in the front office?
The GM has to come first. I mean, that's just the logical way to go, and that's the way you see pretty much any winning organization doing it. You don't want to force a coach on a GM, and you don't want to force a marriage between two guys who, look at Pettine and Farmer right now. Farmer didn't hire Pettine, and they clearly, there's a disconnect there. Whether they say everything's fine, they went on that retreat after last season, and everyone involved said everything was great, and they get along fine, they communicate, blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, it's pretty clear that with the stuff that Mike Pettine does and some of the stuff Farmer has said without saying, there's a disconnect there, and this is a forced marriage. I mean, you have to have whoever is running your football side, whether it's a GM, whether it's a coach GM, whether it's a Bill Parcells type who's like serving as the president of football ops and hiring people below him, it's got to be that person has to hire the coach if he's not the coach. That's the way it should work. And if going forward, if they shake it up again, I would think that's the way it's going to be. One guy that I'm kind of interested in, and I haven't heard that he's a possibility for the Browns or anything like that, is if you are going to go the coach route first, it's got to be maybe like a Sean Payton type, if him and the Saints cut ties after the season. Just somebody like that who has the cachet to give him the keys. I mean, you can't give the keys to a coordinator type like Mike Pettine was, or if you hire, I'm drawing a blank on the Giants offensive coordinator now, who Joe Banner was high on, but just like somebody like that and was improving as a head coach. You don't give that guy the keys. If you're going to hire that guy again, which the Browns seem to do every time, it's always the coordinator guy. But if you're going to hire that guy again, it's got to be the personnel guy, the GM who's hiring him. But that Sean Payton to me is an interesting name to keep an eye on. Keep an eye on, just because everything you hear coming out of New Orleans is that if the Saints ownership goes the way he thinks it's going to go with Rita Benson taking over and calling the shots, that he wants out. And if he wants out, then I'm Jimmy Haslam. That's the guy I'm targeting, because he's had some shaky moments the last couple of years. But, I mean, the guy won a Super Bowl, and he was pretty universally regarded as an excellent coach until a couple down years here. So if they are going to do something like that, that's the way. You've got to get a proven head coach guy that you're going to give the keys to. It's got to be someone like Sean Payton, someone with that kind of cachet.
Here's the other thing that gets me, and, you know, in all my years, and, you know, I'm only 27, but I've been a Browns fan my entire life, and, you know, certainly have been pretty plugged in the last, 10 or more years. To me, this is the most interesting time to be a fan, and I say that because I think there's a part of our fan base that's becoming apathetic, and I've never seen that before, ever, including, you know, when we were really bad under Eric Mangini, when we were really bad under Pat Shurmur. You know, I keep remembering the sign at the stadium when we were 0-5, and we had a home game, and it said 11-5, starts now. You know, there wasn't the apathy. You know, people still cared. And I think we're getting to the point where some people are becoming apathetic, but I think there's a larger portion of the fan base that's turning scared. And I hear this argument all the time, and I want to get your thoughts on this. There are people, I hear it way too much to just kind of dismiss it, because I would never take this seriously. There are people that say, you can't fire Ray Farmer and Mike Pettine, because who in their right mind would want this job? And nobody's going to want this job, so you just got to stay the course for continuity. Now, my argument to that is, this is the National Football League, and you've got ownership with a lot of money that they can spend. You cannot keep incompetent people on board just because you don't think there's anybody else that will want the job. There's only 32 jobs as a head coach in the world. there's only 32 general manager or pro personnel jobs in the world. So, you know, to me, you can always find somebody. And I just wonder, are you hearing that? I mean, you're obviously in touch with the fans and you're on Twitter. Do you hear people say that? And what are your thoughts when people do say that?
Oh, yeah, there's definitely that perception that the Browns' hands are partially tied because people don't want the job. And, I mean, there's a little bit of truth to that. There, I mean, you're not going to get certain candidates because they know how dysfunctional it has been for the last 17 seasons. I mean, there's going to be some of that. But if you're going to hire some kind of personnel czar to be the GM, president of football ops, whatever the title is, and you're Jimmy Haslam and you have plenty of financial resources to do so, if you're going to throw $7, $8, $9, $10 million a year at somebody, you're going to get a good candidate to be your guy. So, I mean, like you said, there are only 32 of these jobs, and if you have an attractive enough position and that person knows that they're going to be in charge and that they don't have to deal with some of the crap that's going on here because it's going to be their show and they can hire and fire who they want, assuming Jimmy's okay with it. I mean, you obviously have to answer to Jimmy, but if that's the case, then I think you're going to be able to find, you could find a good candidate, no matter if you're in Cleveland, Buffalo, wherever, it doesn't matter. One other thing I was going to add is if you're going to keep Farmer, I highly, highly, highly doubt this is going to happen. But if just for argument's sake, if Haslam was going to say, okay, I'm keeping Ray, he's my guy, I don't think we've given him long enough time. Ray, what do you want to do? And Farmer, of course, would say, well, I think we should hire a new coach. That's when you're really going to have a problem hiring somebody. Because getting a head coach to work under Farmer with everything that's gone on, is you're not. That's the case where the fan skepticism would be right on point, where your candidate pool is going to get shrunk considerably because somebody's not going to want to work in that environment knowing that everything that Patton had to deal with, and they hear more than we do. So that's one case where I think their hands could be tied. But if they bring in somebody and tell them this is your show, run it, then you could get a heck of a candidate.
Now, here's a question that I've always had, and I don't think we know the answer to this. And I'm very critical of a couple things with the Browns. I think their fan outreach has been poor this year. Now, granted, they're 2-7, so it's hard to have a real positive rapport with the fans. But you know, I want to bring in Alex Shiner to the conversation just temporarily, because number one, I guess my question would be, how large does he loom in this whole thing? You hear from Joe Banner tweets out and then, of course, says, well, I didn't mean it, and that's not what I was referring to. But he basically tweeted out that Alec has Jimmy's ear more than anybody else. But then you also hear the stories that are leaked to the media that the coaching staff's upset, that Alec's getting involved in football decisions, I think you can sense a little disconnect between Ray and Alec and Jimmy. And so moving forward, and I've always been the proponent of let the president of the team or the business guy, the business operations guy of the team, let him run the business side. Let him take care of the ticket revenue and, you know, pricing decisions and the stadium, which, by the way, you know, he did a great job with. I mean, that stadium is phenomenal. They did a phenomenal job with that. But stay out of football. Have somebody who's singularly in charge of football. I mean, this whole idea that, hey, we're all a team and we go on a retreat together and we all collaboratively make these decisions together and everything's great, that's such BS, because as you know, when something goes wrong, it's ultimately going to be somebody's fault. Somebody drafted Johnny Manziel. The four of them didn't sit together and say, hey, Johnny, let's do it. Somebody drafted Justin Gilbert, and we'll never know who for sure, but somebody did. That could have been Petten's call. That could have been Ray Farmer's call. Jimmy could have played a role in Johnny. Alec could have played a role while drafting Johnny. So moving forward, and when you're trying to attract high-quality NFL candidates, how large does Alec Shiner loom over the process? Do you think that he's going to be involved in the hiring again? Is this whole big party of collaboration, or do you think they finally moved to a structure where football is football, and whoever they hire to run that department has the accountability to do it?
No, yeah, that's definitely the way it should be. I know that Alex, I mean, from everything I've heard and from what I'm pretty confident in knowing is that Alex definitely does have Jimmy there. I mean, Alex is somebody that Jimmy trusts. Alex has a very good reputation in the NFL from the business community for doing some of the things he did with the Cowboys and the role he played with the building of that stadium and then with what he's done here. I mean, he's a respected guy. He's a smart guy. He's sharp. He's aging. So, I mean, he's got good stuff going for him. As far as how much he's involved in football, I mean, obviously, Jason Lockham had that story was the last year that just caused a ton of controversy and really got people thinking about how it's done. But I don't know how much he really is. I know he told me that he does watch film with Ray. He told me that, and he said that he thinks that it's good to know as much as much about an organization as possible, whether it's football, business, whatever, and that all makes sense to me. I don't know that he's like telling Farmer what he should do with draft picks or Pettman what he should do with coaching decisions. I highly doubt he would be doing that. What I could see happening, and I don't know that this is happening, but I think this is a possibility, is if you look at the way like smart NBA front offices are done with analytics, just with like the approach like the Warriors and Cavs and some organizations take where you have these analytics guys who study trends and everything else, and they report what they find to the coach, to the general manager, that kind of stuff. And then if a coach has a question about something or a general manager has a question about, hey, so what kind of value does this guy have? And what's this lottery draft pick worth like compared to player? What kind of player do you get back? That you have that kind of back and forth between analytics guys and basketball guys. You have that in football to a lesser extent, but so I can see that going on where Farmer might be asking Alex compensation questions or like value questions as far as contracts and that kind of stuff. But I highly doubt that Alex is getting involved in who Mike Pettine should be starting at quarterback and that kind of stuff. I really don't see that happening. I mean, they've made plenty of mistakes in that. This regime has made plenty of mistakes, but I don't think that's one that they're making. I don't think you have Alex Shiner getting involved with what Mike Pettine's doing and with certain things that Ray Farmer's doing. He might be involved in like certain analytical discussions, but I don't think he's getting in too far into the football specific.
All right, you know, and that's all. It's all good Brown stuff. It's so depressing to talk about, Kevin. It just is. The city is so starved, and you know we have the Cavs, who are doing very well, and we'll talk about them in a minute. But, you know, we all know this city is a Browns town, and I think a lot of people were encouraged, including myself, with Mike Pettine and the way that last year started and the 7-4 record. And I do want to get your thoughts on Pettine. I know we talked a lot about Farmer. We talked a lot of Jimmy and Alec. Here's where I come from with Mike, and tell me if you agree or disagree. I loved him last year. I really did. I thought, you know, his demeanor in press conferences, I thought, you know, kind of that tough guy look was exactly what Cleveland needed. The no-nonsense, the, you know, comparisons to Stone Cold Steve Austin, you know, just the way he carried himself, I loved. And I loved his coaching through the majority of the season. Even when we were losing at the end, I thought he was aggressive when needed. You know, I thought the team made strides, especially you know, under Kyle Shanahan on offense, that the first 8 games were great. And it's interesting with Shanahan because you're seeing now the same pattern play out in Atlanta where, you know, they had the great, phenomenal start. And, you know, they lost at San Francisco yesterday, and they ran the ball, like, for 12 yards. Devontae Freeman had 12 carries for 12 yards. And all of a sudden, they can't run it either, which is kind of the same thing that happened to us midway through the year. But here's my thing with Pettine. Number one, I think there's zero accountability in the locker room. I think different players get treated in different ways. You know, the way that they've managed certain things has really kind of rubbed me the wrong way. You know, I think there's accountability from the standpoint that, yeah, he's willing to play younger guys over like a Dwayne Bowe. He's not just going to hand a Dwayne Bowe a roster spot, or a guy like Johnny or Justin Gilbert roster spots because of where they were picked. But at the same time, you know, you hear about last year, Justin Gilbert, you know, according to some reports, was late like, you know, 20 times to meetings. And it only took until the last week for him to be disciplined for that. Johnny, you know, all of his escapades, it only took, you know, until the last week for him to be disciplined. There was no discipline with this latest incident with Johnny. Justin Gilbert gets in an accident, you know, racing cars and being spit on by old men, apparently, or his car, who knows. But all of that stuff, it seems to me, from a locker room standpoint, there's not a lot of accountability. And then you go onto the field, and here's where I really get to accountability, which is part of his whole play like a Brown mantra, which is the stupidest damn thing ever. Because, you know, when your team has the worst record in the NFL since they returned in 1999, it's important to make your rally cry, play like a Brown. I mean, it makes no sense from a PR standpoint. Again, I wish I worked in PR for the Browns. But Mike Pettine, oh, man. I mean, it's just, when you look at that defense, and this is what gets me worried. The only thing I ever want out of a coach, and you know, I'm not married to a style or a type of coach or whether he's a yeller and a screamer or whether he's not. The only thing that I want out of a coach is a guy who can take the talent that he has and put a game plan together that maximizes that talent. And I don't see that at all. With Mike Pettine. I think John DeFilippo does it a lot more on offense than what we're seeing on defense. But to me, on defense, we've got like the fourth highest paid defense in the NFL. And for Mike to say, hey, well, our scheme is our scheme, and we're not going to change our scheme, and we're just going to hold our corners out on an island, no matter if it's Pierre Desir or Justin Gilbert or Joe Hayden, even when he's playing like, you know, he's a JV football player, and he's hurt and he's injured. The scheme can't stop the run. They haven't done anything creative to try to change the scheme. It's just, well, our players have to play better. And to me, it's like, well, no. You know, you've got some talent here, albeit, you know, no depth at all. And the amount of talent is arguable, but there is talent. And you've got to try to maximize that talent to the best of your ability. And I just see the kind of stubbornness that says, hey, my way or the highway. You know, we're going to keep doing my thing and just hope it works better. I don't know if you see any of that. What are your thoughts in general of Mike Pettine?
I kind of went the same way as you. Last year, I was pretty high on him. I thought he did a hell of a job, even though they closed the season in typical Browns fashion, where they lost five games in a row and had some, and they had the typical quarterback injuries, and they're ending the year with the guy. That you would have thought would be starting a game for the Browns. But and overall, I mean, 7-9 is much better than a lot of the stuff we've been watching since 1999. But this year, for whatever reason, I've completely soured on him. I remember telling somebody who works for the Browns, like, I can't remember if it was in the summer or if it was last spring, but I said, anytime you guys have any kind of bad news or any kind of controversy, you should throw Mike Pettine in front of a microphone.
Yeah.
Everyone feels better. I mean, that's the way it was last year. When he talked, people would criticize Jimmy, they would criticize Farmer, they took their shots at Alec, but when Pettine got in front of a microphone, he kind of made the fans feel better. This year, that hasn't been the case. This year, they want to see more. They think he's too laid back. They think he's too robotic, and that's pretty much what you see on game day. He has that tough guy, Macho Man Savage kind of look to him. He's always got that scowl on his face, but he never seems to be showing any kind of emotion. He never seems to be too up or down. I mean, it's good to be in control. That's what you want your coach to be, but you still want to see him show some kind of emotion. I mean, you still want to see something.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's guys who are pretty damn good like Belichick, but I don't know. There's something different about him this year, and I don't know if it's just that he knows he's been dealt a crappy hand, and he's kind of resigned to the fact that it's not going to work. I don't know if that's it or if it's just, I can't put my finger on it, but there's something different this year. That training camp they had, I wasn't there every day, I was only out there a couple times, but by all accounts, it was a joke. I mean, you had guys on bikes who were nursing incredibly minor injuries, veteran days off for guys who didn't deserve a day off.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous. And that's obviously carry over into the season. And I think the tipping point for him here, at least in the minds of the fans, was that halftime interview he gave Thursday night.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I'm not a fan of Manziel. I mean, I don't think he's going to be a good NFL quarterback, but I'm open to the possibility that he could be okay. And from what he showed in the first half Thursday night, I mean, he looked like a somewhat exciting, somewhat legitimate NFL quarterback. I mean, he's always going to be tiny. He's always going to lack certain things, but he was pretty darn good on the road against a 7-0 team. And then Patton gives a halftime interview where he acted like Manziel was 6-for-20 and all he wanted to do was get outside the pocket and blah, blah, blah. And he completely just shot down anything Manziel had done and acted like that Johnny wasn't fitting their mold of what a quarterback had to be. And that just told me right there that, I mean, one, they don't trust Manziel, which is what we all expect, what we all suspected. Two, they don't think he's any good, which, I mean, we kind of all thought that the coaches thought that anyway. And three, he's way, way, way too stubborn about what he wants in certain situations. I mean, NFL coaches have to adapt. They have to be flexible. They have to be open to doing new things and doing things that fit their personnel. And with Johnny, I mean, you can't expect him to stay in the pocket all the time. His best quality is getting outside the pocket and throwing on the run or making something happen with his feet. You can't live off of that in the NFL. I mean, that's been proven time and time again. There are certain guys who have defied the odds, like Cam Newton. But for the most part, I mean, you can't do it. I mean, look at RG3. He had the one good year, and he hasn't been the same since. But you can do it a little bit, and you can't encourage. I mean, you have to encourage Manziel to be who he is at times. You can't just have him be a in-the-pocket robot, especially, I mean, hell, he's lucky if they list him at, 6 foot? He's lucky if he's 5'10".
Yeah, yeah.
He's not the type that you can just have do a 7-step drop and just sit there. He's going to get killed, and he can't see over the lineman half the time. So it doesn't make sense to me. I really thought that interview was kind of a tipping point with Patton and the fans. They were already frustrated, but once they heard that, and you were on Twitter, I'm sure, and during that game, as soon as he said that, everyone was like, what the hell is he saying right now? That was not good for him, and I don't know, there's so many things going on this year that just are not making him look good, and I just wonder about how good of a coach he is now. I mean, he could be a hell of a coordinator, and that's his role in the NFL, and that's fine. There's plenty of guys who are good coordinators that weren't the best head coaches. He might have fit into that mold, but I just can't see how he's the guy here. I just don't see it.
Well, believe me, on Twitter, I was leading the charge. I mean, that's the first time, really, I think, in Browns history that our halftime adjustment was exactly what the other team said out loud that their halftime adjustment would be. I mean, it's so ironic and ridiculous and stupid that, you know, on national television, our coach, who, by the way, I didn't think that interview was a good look for it. He just, you know, the stadium was kind of quiet. We had just scored a touchdown, and I think it was Tracy Wolfson who interviewed him. You know, She asked him a question, and he's like screaming into the microphone. You know, like, oh, well, you know, hey, oh, what? And then, you know, Johnny Manziel, who, you know, like him or not, and I'm in the same exact boat that you are with him, and we'll expound on that in a second, but like him or not, you know, he just led the team down for a touchdown. You're in the game with Cincinnati, who's undefeated, and you're 2-6, and it's like, what do you have to lose? I mean, that's the one game that, as a coach, you know what they're trying to do on defense. And this has been my problem with Patton all year long. There's no thought into, okay, what is the other team trying to take away from us? What are they trying to do to affect us? It's just, well, what do I want to see our guys do? And you can't coach like that. And for him to stand there and say, oh, hey, well, you know, Johnny's got to calm down. We need him to stay in the pocket. And you know, I know he came out the next day and he said, hey, listen, I didn't really mean that I wanted him to just exclusively be in the pocket, but that's exactly what he meant. He didn't want Johnny running around. He didn't want him to make plays his way. He wanted him to make plays in a quote-unquote NFL way, where you got to stand tall like Josh McCown and fire it from the pocket. And that is such a disconnect with, number one, where the league's going, but number two, the way that the other team wants you to play that way. So, you know, like Marvin Lewis, of all people, who Marvin Lewis isn't the sharpest game coach in the shed, and he sits there and says, well, we want to keep Johnny in the pocket in the second half. That's what we got to do. We got to keep the quarterback in the darn pocket. And then our coach comes out and says, yeah, we got to keep our own quarterback in the darn pocket. I mean, like, hello? That's like the most ridiculous. And for me, you know, as Browns fans, think about this, Kevin. That's coming off of a week where 2 days before the general manager gives a press conference where, that was one of the worst press conferences I've ever seen, ever. His body language, his demeanor, I mean, he just looked like, you know, for right or for wrong, and I don't ever fault anybody for sweating up on the podium or having anxiety about that, but the man looked like he wanted to run away, you know, and rightfully so, but he did not look like a man in control of the franchise. And so for a Browns fan, you go from 2 days before your general manager just looking totally, totally, you know, inept, to then your head coach on national television saying, yeah, our quarterback was terrible. You know, we got to calm him down. You got to calm him down. He led a 92-yard drive and he scored a touchdown. You got to calm him down. Like, yeah. What? That's a Pat Shurmur quote. So that's the disconnect. And you spoke exactly to it. It's the stubbornness, the whole my way or the highway. You know, we're going to do this my way. Well, you know, your way's 2-7. How's that working out for you? And the last thing I'll say about him, if I were a head coach and I were in his situation right now and I realized I'm 2-7, you know, I don't have much going for me right now and I'm probably going to be fired at the end of the year, I would do anything. I would open my playbook so far up and you know, trick play after trick play and be so aggressive. Like, what do I have to lose? I'm going to fight like hell for my job, right? And it just seems like he gets up there to a fan base that is so weary, and he's like, "Oh well, you know, hey, our defense didn't work today, but we'll evaluate the mistakes and we'll get them fixed, and we'll be prepared next time." Well, yeah, well apparently not, you know. And how long is that Mike Pettin going to be around until we can finally see a Mike Pettin that, you know, actually wants to fight for that? To me, that's all this ever. Who cares what he looks like on the sideline? This is Cleveland. This is a blue-collar town. This is a fan base that is desperate for a winner, and you got a head coach that looks like he doesn't, you know, have a pulse. It's just maddening. The one thing I do want to ask you before we go to the Indians and the Cavs, and again, we really thank you, Kevin, for taking the time out to do this, but the Johnny Manziel factor, and again, I'm on record saying I'm in the same boat as you are. I don't think he's the long-term answer. Here's what concerns me, and this is, you know, new and fresh. And, you know, he has the game first of all, he had a great game against Tennessee where he really did play well. He gets yanked, and then the whole situation with his girlfriend in the car, and it's still being investigated. While he's under NFL investigation, and he knows he's not in the great graces of our coaching staff, this weekend, he goes to College Station, and there are photos of him with girls and partying, and one where it very much looks like he's got a beer in his hands. For a guy that's fresh out of rehab, not a really good look, and certainly not something that you would say, hey, I'm going to hang my hat on that guy. Don't you agree?
Oh, yeah. That's one thing. That's the perfect example of a reason to defend Penn right now. That's why these guys don't trust him. Johnny, that's plain and simple. They do not trust him because of what you saw. I mean, he went to A&M, he might have partied with some old buddies, and that was it. Fine, good. I mean, if anyone else did that, I wrote this today, if anyone else did that, it wouldn't be a big deal. But if it's Johnny Manziel, 7 months out of rehab, and a few weeks after that roadside incident where a couple people called 911, and said he was driving 90 miles an hour on the berm of I-90, and his girlfriend, who was heavily intoxicated, according to the police, was saying that he was beating the crap out of her, and then later kind of backtracked. Once you throw all that in, it's just incredibly poor decision making. I mean, you want to, I don't know the specifics behind his rehab and what he was in for and all that kind of stuff. You've heard rumors that it was alcohol and whatever else, but I don't know for sure what it was, but it's just not a good look. And if you're going to do that, I know anyone who's had drinking problems, they say, and you shouldn't be in bars and you shouldn't be around it.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
If he really thinks that he's able to manage it, if he's confident in that and he's able to have a couple beers and that's it, like most of us do from time to time, then fine. But why are you letting these college girls take pictures of you? I mean, you know it's going to be all over. If you have a 19, 20, 21-year-old girl who's drinking, taking pictures of you, what do you think is going to happen? I mean, that's just common sense. I mean, you could ask them not to post it or whatever, but then the next day, that all got around Sunday. So maybe, for all we know, he might have said, look, this can't go anywhere. Keep it between you and your friends or whatever. And then next thing you know, it's on busted coverage and everywhere else. And
yeah.
One of them was tweeting about it, and the other one was interacting with it, and then the busted coverage or Bro Bible, one of those gossip sites had the entire conversation between college girls. So, I mean, it's just common sense. It's just something that he just lacks. He's a sharp guy. He really is. When you hear him interviewed, he's a pro. I think he's going to end up being on TV someday. He's going to be a pretty good football analyst. But just he lacks the self-awareness with certain things. I mean, he still wants to have that Johnny Football persona. But with what he's had happen in the rear view, it's not smart. And it's not going to lead to a long career. I mean, when people don't trust you, when your employer doesn't trust you, I mean, you're screwed. I mean, you're absolutely screwed. So it's obvious that I know Browns fans, and I would agree with them here, want Manziel to start Sunday against Pittsburgh. But if McCown is healthy, I'm pretty confident in thinking that Patton's just going to go right back to McCown. Everyone's going to be ticked off. And here we go again. We're playing a 36-year-old over somebody that possibly could be a decent quarterback in the NFL who's much younger. But I guess that remains to be seen. But that's my guess right now. Patton's going to go back to McCown, and everyone's going to be ticked off.
Yeah, I would agree with that. All right, enough depressing Browns talk. It's just, my goodness. Psychiatrists in Northeast Ohio they love this, you know. They absolutely love this because I'm sure they've made quite a bit on the Browns over the years. Let's turn to the Indians. You know, Mark Shapiro is now gone. I, you know, have been beating the drums on Twitter for a long time that I'm not a big Mark. I'll be honest, I'm not a Mark Shapiro fan. I think he unbelievably overvalues prospects and assets. And, you know, now granted, he didn't have ownership that was willing to, when he did put a core in place, or when his baseball people did put a core in place, to actually spend over the top, the way you see like a team like the Royals do when they win the World Series. But he goes to Toronto, and that's a funny story in and of itself, because their GM then resigns and says, no way am I working with this guy. And the Toronto media kind of smartens up to the fact of, well, what has he really actually done in Cleveland? And to be fair to Mark, he's done a lot, I think, with the resources that he's been given. But I think he and others have given himself a little more credit than what he probably deserves. So now we're faced with Chris Antonetti and Kevin Chernoff, and here we go. Is it kind of the same old philosophy where, hey, we're going to continue to overvalue prospects, and you know, or is this the time where Antonetti goes to Paul Dolan, and who knows if the funds are available or not, and says, hey, we have a really good core group of players. We have a phenomenal pitching staff. I need a little bit of money to put us over the top. Do you see a shift change in anything in the front office, or do you think this is just kind of same old Indians?
I think this is going to be one of the more interesting Indians off-seasons in quite a while. And I'm not saying that because I think they're going to make a ton of moves and sign seven guys and whatever else. But I just think it's going to be really, really interesting to see what they do, because they have an elite pitching staff. They have a pitching staff that could win a World Series. I really believe that. But they can't go with the status quo with this lineup that they have. I mean, they were 19th or 20th in baseball in runs per game last year. And I mean, you can't score four point one runs a game, whatever it was, and expect to win a pennant. That's just not how it works, even with that pitching staff that they have. So, and they have to do something. And what's going to be intriguing is to see what the Dolans allow Antonetti to do. They're searching for a minority investor right now, and I think that's gonna end up being pretty darn important, because depending on if that search is successful and who is the person that invests in the team and how much they invest, and it's going to be a minority stake. But if that person is investing a pretty sizable chunk of change, how much is Paul Dolan then willing to spend on this year's team? Is he going to pocket it because it's going to go toward expenses because they've been losing money some of these years, or is he going to spend a chunk of it on the team this year? I don't know the answer to that, and until we know who this investor is and how much he or she is investing, we're not going to know that. But my guess right now is it's going to be a lot of the same stuff that we've seen under Mark Shapiro, where they're going to be conservative. They're going to keep that payroll in the 85, 87, 89 million range, and they won't have a ton of wiggle room. Jordan Bastian of MLB.com wrote something last week that broke down the tribe's payroll situation coming up, and he had them in the 70 to 75 million range if they return everyone from last year. Yeah. And he counted a chunk of what they owed Swisher and Bourne, because they threw in a pretty sizable chunk of change to Atlanta in that deal. So he had them at 70, 75 million. So if that's the case, then, and they're going to be consistent with what they've spent the last 2 years with Tito, then we're looking at 10 to 15 million tops that they have to add to the payroll. I mean, Colby Rasmus, for God's sake, is going to get 14 million dollars a year. I mean, you're not going to spend your entire budget on Colby Rasmus, especially since he's going to have more than one suitor anyway. Just MLB free agency is such a risky game, and I agree with Shapiro to a certain extent with some of the things he's done, because so many of these MLB free agent signings, especially the big ones, the long-term ones, they don't work out. Or if they do work out, they work out for a year or two, and then they just end up being absolute albatross.
Sure.
I mean, Pujols is the extreme example of it, but there's so many other examples you can use where guys break down, they sign them on the back end of their career, and once they get into that year three, year four, it's an untradeable contract, and a guy that you have no business playing, but you're playing them just because you're paying them. So there is some value into some of the stuff that Shapiro believed in and some of the stuff they've done. But I really think it's going to be conservative. If they're going to keep that payroll in that same range, their best chance to improve the lineup isn't free agency. It's trade. It's trading one of those pitchers for a couple bats. But if you're going to do that, it better darn well be a major league ready bat. It's got to be a proven MLB young up and coming type of guy. It can't be a prospect flatter. That's just not going to fly with what they have right now. Their window is now. They have Kipnis and Brantley and Gomes and those guys under control for a few more years. Their window is now. Carrasco's locked up. Hoover's locked up. Now is their time to win. And that's the approach that they need to take. And that's the approach I think they're going to take, but they're not going to be as aggressive as far as signings as fans want to be ahead. Unless this investor completely changes the dynamic, which would be interesting to see happen, but I doubt that'll be the case.
All right, well, you knew I was going to ask you this, or at least we didn't talk about this, but you may have had an idea that I'd ask you this, because you and I on Twitter, and please, I tell you all the time, people, he is the best. I'm telling you, the best follow in Cleveland sports. So please follow him on Twitter. It's worth your while. I promise access to great articles. It's at Kevin Kleps, Kleps. Give him a follow because it's really good stuff. But you and I on Twitter have been talking about this for a while. And I'm going to give Alex Shiner credit here because I said earlier in the podcast he's done such a great job with the Brown Stadium renovations. So let's talk about Progressive Field for a second because I think the Indians get like this free pass on this. The drawings and the renderings of what right field was supposed to look like, I thought, you know, this is great. You know, they're going to, this is cutting edge and, you know, it's going to make a beautiful ballpark look even better. What in the hell happened to the renovate? Like, there was no announcements like, well, you know, we're kind of cutting back a little bit. And I know this is privately funded, so maybe the Dolans ran out of money. But, like, how do you just stick, like, 10 boxes up in the, and this has nothing to do with the corner and the bar and the district and all that. That's great. But upper deck and right field, like, for what they told us it was going to be to what it is like nowhere. It'd be like the Browns drawing up what we have now at First Energy Stadium and then just putting like a giant circular scoreboard up there on top of what we already had. What is that with the white boxes? And do you think that they get like a, am I crazy and just like harping on this forever? Am I not the only one that recognizes this? How?
You're far from alone in that. I mean, anytime I've ever tweeted or written about any kind of Progressive Field renovation, it's not just you. There's always someone who responds, well, what about those upper deck boxes in right field? What about those shipping containers? What the hell were they thinking there? And I mean, I've asked them about it, and they admit that that's the one criticism they've gotten. They do admit that, but they're not going to say, oh, we ran out of money, we did this, we cut a corner here, we did that. And I honestly don't know how it came to be. It's different than a rendering, but I mean, that happens all the time in any kind of major construction, especially stadium and arena. I mean, the renderings are just that, they're drawings. They're kind of like a rough draft, and things change as you go and you start on the project. So, I mean, that's no different than any other thing, but just the way they ended up doing it with a shipping container look is not, I mean, I'll admit it is an eyesore. From a distance, it's an eyesore. But I will just defend them in one regard, and I think I told you this. When you're up there, not that they have a lot of people up there because they have those attendance problems, but if they were ever to start packing the park on a regular basis like they used to, I think people's perception of that area would change. Because if you're up there, which I've been a couple times, it's really cool. I mean, it really is. You don't see you're not seeing the shipping container. You're seeing a party deck with a perfect view of a really nice ballpark, and you're seeing views of the Cleveland skyline, which, and on a nice summer night, it's actually really cool. My wife had a company picnic in that area, and it was awesome. I mean, people are up there drinking, having a good time, and you have such a good view of the park. It really is cool. Anyone who doesn't like the way it looks, I totally get it, and I'm with you. It doesn't look good from a distance. It looks pretty damn bad. But when you're up, if you do believe that, and if you do think that way, just if you haven't been up there, just check it out. I mean, go up there and just look at the ballpark and just look at what it provides. It's pretty cool. The problem for them is, in regards to that area, is it's empty so often because they have problems bringing people into the park, which is a discussion that's been going on for years and years. And until they dramatically improve on the field, it's going to be an issue for them. It's not going to stop until they get off to a strong start and until they contend all year long and just get people in that way. But it is cool, and it's a different kind of experience. But if it's empty all the time and there's 10,000 people in the park, and that area just stands out even more.
Well, but I think the thing with me is, you know, twofold. I think you're right. You know, being up there, and you are right in the sense that in person, you know, I went to a couple games this year. In person, it looks a lot better. But on television, oh, I mean, it just looks bad. To me, I always thought it was kind of their answer to tarping. You know, they just didn't want to throw like Oakland, you know, they put that giant tarp that says Athletics in the upper deck. They didn't want to do that. So let's just build boxes over the seats, you know, like outdoor, they just look like white boxes. And to me, the creativity of it, the fact that they left them white and they kind of look like cinder blocky and, you know, they just don't look that great. But I would imagine, you know, being up there, I always liked those seats, you know, when they were really good. When I was a kid growing up, that was the thing to do with, you know, to go and get like the $10 right field, I think they call it what, mezzanine or whatever it was, seats or the upper seats. Those were great. I didn't mind them. And so, you know, it is what it is, but I just had to ask that on the record because it just looks so different. Like, I understand that there are differences from the drawings and renderings, but I mean, like, you drew the Taj Mahal and then you built me a, you know, 900 foot Cape Cod. You know, that's the analogy that I make from it. But I want to move to the Cavs. You know, I don't want to take up too much of your time, and again, I appreciate you joining us. You know, the Indians, this has always been my thought, and it's kind of an Indians and Cavs question. The attendance thing to me is simple. And I know that a lot of people don't believe this or say that you can't make it this black and white, but I really do believe this. Cleveland sports fans are knowledgeable, and they're very, very knowledgeable, and they've been down so many times, and they've been pushed down, and they've been punched in the gut. I think the only thing that sports fans ask of our owners is that they give everything that they have to give us a title. You know, we want a title, and we don't care how you do it, but what we want to get there. And I think the Indians, certainly when LeBron was in Miami, they had the best chance to deliver on that. And I think they had an opportunity to really win back the entire city and the fan base if they just would have spent a little bit to supplement what they had and make a real run at it instead of just kind of being content with, hey, 500 and let's worry about the payroll. And, you know, I call it Shapiro talk where they're speaking in assets and, you know, financial constraints and all that sort of stuff. I think they had an opportunity to really win the city over, and they didn't do it. Well, now you hear you have the Cavs, where you know, look, Dan Gilbert's a billionaire. He's got a lot more money than Paul Dolan does, and thankfully so. But at the same time, you know, Gilbert is forfeiting quite a bit of profit that he has, even with LeBron back, by going so far over the luxury tax. But I think in the process, he has won the city over even more because he's saying, I will do whatever it takes. And he's showing through his actions, I will do absolutely 100% whatever it takes. I don't care how many hundreds of millions of dollars it costs. I want a championship in the city of Cleveland. And if you give the fan base that, I think they'll respond. Do you agree with that?
Oh, I agree totally. You really have to commend what they're doing, and they're going all in. I mean, that Kevin Love deal is going to be scrutinized for years and years just because Andrew Wiggins looks like he's going to be, I mean, phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. And I mean, 10 years from now, when Kevin Love probably isn't playing anymore, or if he is playing, he's a broken down shell of himself. Wiggins and will still be one of the top probably five players in the league. So it's going to be scrutinized from that angle. But for the time being, the deal made sense for them, and it just showed how committed Gilbert was to ending this championship drought. I mean, they brought LeBron back. LeBron wanted Kevin Love, and that's what they're doing. They're going all in for a championship now, and you got to commend that. And they really seem to be hell-bent on not just winning a title, but ending the Cleveland Kirk and doing it for the city. That seems to be something that they talk about a lot, and something that's a driving force for them, where they not only do they want to win a championship because who the heck doesn't want to win a championship, but because of what it would mean to the city and just this ridiculously long drought that the city's been on. They really want to be the ones that end it. And they're obviously the closest, and who knows, it could be this year. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah, and you know, you look at the Indians on the other end. Here's what I'll tell anybody when they talk about the attendance issues with the Indians. I went, was it 2 or 3 years ago now, when we had the one game playoff against Tampa Bay, and I went to that game and I attended that game, and I've also been a Brown season ticket holder since '99. I was at the finals last year with the Cavs, the Eastern Conference Finals. The only reason I bring that up is to say that atmosphere at Progressive Field during that one game playoff was equally as loud as the atmosphere in the queue for the NBA Finals. I mean, fans were into it. They were standing and cheering and chanting and all game long, not just at the start, really all game long. And it was a pretty boring game. We lost it 3-0. But they were into it, and they were hungry, and they cared. And it was like the Indians of the 90s. And I've always felt that if you just got an owner that would spend, and rightfully or wrongly, and you know, they did on Nick Swisher and Michael Bourne, which, you know, that's to me, that's a real stain on Mark Shapiro's time here, and certainly on Chris Antonetti. Those two free agent signings were horrid. Just really, really bad on a lot of accounts. But if they just give the impression that we care and we're going all in, I think they pack the park. Now, would they sell out every night like the 90s? No, they would not. But I think there a lot more people would go than are going now. I mean, they still draw 25,000 for a weekend game, and certainly fireworks nights are very popular. But, you know, are fireworks bringing 10,000 more people to the ballpark? No, I think people genuinely still care about the Indians. It's just they need an ownership group that they don't look at as cheap. You know, why would you want to spend as a fan, and this is my argument to everybody, why as a fan would you want to spend your hard-earned money on an ownership group that doesn't really want to spend its hard-earned money? You know what I mean?
Yeah, it would be a really, I mean, it's not going to happen, but it would be a really intriguing test case to see what would happen if they, say, increased the payroll by $40 million.
Yeah.
1 year and see what they did. But like I said before, free agency in MLB is, I mean, a lot of times it's fool's gold. It just doesn't work. So there's different ways they would have to do that other than just signing some high price over the hill kind of guy. But in certain situations, if there is a younger guy who's a free agent, or if there's a guy available in a trade who might have a kind of expensive contract that somebody wants to get rid of, then those are the kinds of situations you can count on. But I wonder if they did do that, how much of an impact it would have. To me, it's not as much about the spending. Obviously, the spending would help. And, I mean, when you have more of a payroll to work with, you have, I mean, there are, you're able to take more chances and you can afford more swings and misses than you can when you have an $85 million payroll. But I'm not sure it would cause this old school Jacobs Field attendance bump. I just don't see it happening. And I think that's something that would, that's part of the reason you're not seeing the spending that fans would like, because I don't know how well that would work. They need, and maybe spending would be the answer to this, but they need to have, their problem, even when they've had some good years, is that they have these awful starts. So the April has just been their nightmare. If they could somehow get a fast start in April, and if they could somehow get 10, 12 games over 500 in May and just carry it over and just keep going, and you're going to have lulls in a 162-game season, but not have these extended periods where they stink, where they're just playing boring baseball. If they could somehow get off to a strong start, get in first place, and stay there for most of the year, then I want to see what happens with attendance. That, I think, to me, is the true case. That's the true test. Not how much they spend, but actually being able to sustain success early, or get the success early and just sustain it. That's been their problem. Even when they had that, I mean, that 2013 wild card year, and they had to win their last 10 games just to make the wild card because they got off to such a bad start.
Right.
Same thing in 2014 and 2015. And in 2014, it cost them a playoff spot. Last year, they got back in the race late, But, I mean, let's be honest, they were 81-80. There's no way in heck that team would make the playoffs. But in 2014, that's when it started costing them a back-to-back playoff. So, yeah, spending would help, and maybe that would get you – that would help you get to that fast start. But, I mean, they have enough talent to win a division. They really do. I mean, there's not a ton of difference between them and the Royals. The Royals have the lineup advantage. The Indians have better pitching. Their problem has been these slow starts have just absolutely hamstrung them for the rest of the year. They're always playing catch up, and I mean, anyone listening to us knows Northeast Ohio weather is just, it's not conducive to baseball in the spring, and that's something else that hurts them, especially with the Cavs being good. And the 90s were a perfect storm for the Indians. I mean, the Browns were gone. The Cavs, and just everything that could possibly be in the Indians' favor. You had young prospects who were getting into their best years, who hadn't yet become ridiculously expensive. It was just a perfect storm of a baseball situation for middle to lower market, lower size market. But now, I mean, that's not the case now. With the Cavs being as good as they are, some people aren't paying attention to the Indians until June. I mean, they'll watch some games here and there in April and May, but they're focused on the Cavs and the playoffs, and then you throw in the NFL draft and some other stuff that's going on in the NFL offseason, which never seems to end. And NFL 365 days a year now, but it's different for the Indians now, and they're really struggling to get anyone other than the diehard fans back. The casual fans might go a game here and there, but they're not going to go in April when it's crappy outside. They're not going to go in May unless it's really nice. And if they do go in May and it's really nice, chances are it's going to be on the weekends when it's easier if they have kids in school or whatever else. It's just, there's a lot of factors working against the Indians from that perspective, and I just wonder what they can do. And the renovations, we've talked about them. I mean, aside from the Harrises in the upper deck and right field, the renovations were really, really nice. And their attendance dropped this year. The team obviously wasn't as good, but they weren't one of the worst in MLB by any means. They were a 500 team. That's not great, but for attendance to drop when you had this extra incentive to get there, that's kind of alarming, and it just makes me wonder how much Cleveland right now supports baseball. It's the billion-dollar question. I wonder, I mean, say you, by some miracle, the Dolans said, okay, we're going to have $150 million payroll this year. Great. I mean, that opens up a lot of possibilities, but would that still translate to 25,000, 30,000 people a game at the gate? I really honestly don't know that. Unless they're in first place all year long, I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that, which is kind of an alarming answer, but I really don't know. I mean, I don't know if the casual fans are as interested in baseball now as they used to be. It's a problem not just in Cleveland. It's a problem in other cities too, but it's more of a problem in Cleveland than it is in some of the other major league markets.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to watch moving forward for sure. And you're right. I mean, with the renovations, the fact that attendance did go down, I mean, they're giving away tickets. And you know, being in Northeast Ohio, there's a lot of times where you can't give away Indians tickets, especially on the weekdays and especially when the weather's bad. So certainly something to watch moving forward. But well, we've hit the hour mark, and Kevin, we appreciate it. I mean, we touched on, I think, really all the big stuff. Again, you can follow him at Kevin Kleps, and we thank him. You know, I said when Ken Carman came on that, you know, Ken was our first guest and probably going to be our best guest. But Kevin, I'll tell you what, from a content perspective, and you and I have known each other for a few years, but this was, I really, really enjoyed this. So I think you just knocked Ken out of the top spot. So sorry, Ken, too bad. But we really appreciate taking the time. Well, thank you again. And, you know, for me, just to be able to provide this content unfiltered to Cleveland fans who really want it. That's what it's all about. And you are one of the best, if not the best, in doing that. So we hope we can have you on again at some point. And thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Adam. I appreciate it.
All right, Kevin Kleps from Cranes Cleveland. That is the Hard Foul Sports Cleveland podcast. We'll be back later in the week with our Cavs edition. And then next week, of course, after the Browns-Pittsburgh game. Boy, that should be a lot of fun to talk about. We'll be back with another edition. You can follow along with everything on hardfoulsports.com. Once again, this has been the Hard Foul Sports Cleveland podcast.